A major political shift in Turkey. For insights, KCSB's Harry Lawton spoke with local expert and author Anne Louise Bardak.
As a result of the recent referendum in Turkey, the country turned from a parliamentary republic to presidential rule. This was entirely the initiative of the president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who appears to have finally tired of a parliamentary system with all its constitutional delays and compromises, and is now ready to reduce the parliament to a rubber stamp, eliminate the position of prime minister, and rule when he deems necessary by decree. This follows the failed coup of last July, when a group of army officers and their loyal cadets attempted to detain Erdogan on vacation at the time and overthrow his government, the AKP, or Justice and Welfare Party. This botched military initiative failed, and Erdogan swiftly exploited the situation to his advantage, arresting and imprisoning many thousands of Turks from the ranks of the army, but also reaching down into the ranks of Turkish civil society, including teachers and academics, judges, and even opposition parliamentarians, and naturally, journalists. Since July, his regime has shut down countless independent radio and TV stations and other outlets. The first instinct of an authoritarian is, of course, to suppress independent press as the core source of opinion contrary to that of the head of state. For a parallel, we need only turn to Putin's Russia. For all his monopoly of the propaganda machinery, Erdogan's margin of victory was narrow, less than 3% of the vote. Whether this will be enough to slow down his ambition to control every aspect of political expression in Turkey is open to debate. And certainly the vote count has come under critical scrutiny in Europe, where the result of the referendum has aroused a genuinely sceptical response. For further insight on the Turkish question, I turn to independent foreign correspondent Anne Louise Bardak, who reported from Turkey in the mid-1990s and observed Erdogan as he began his climb up the rungs of power, first as mayor of Istanbul. Ms. Bardak is best known for her work on Cuba under the Castro regime. She is also the author of After Fidel, and has reported from many points of crisis around the world, and her work can be viewed on her website at bardakreports.com. Anne Louise Bardak reminds us of Erdogan's political roots from when he was elected mayor of Istanbul in 1994 as the Welfare Party candidate. Even then, she says it was apparent that he wanted to move Turkish society in a more religious or Islamic direction, not extremely so, but clearly opposed to the secular tradition established by Kemal Atatürk and supported by the Turkish military.
And when I was in Turkey, I heard from the generals and the military and all the prominent, you know, billionaires and builders and the pillars of Turkish society that Islamicism could never happen in, you know, a fundamentalist Islamic country could never happen there. But, you know, you could see it. Erdogan, you know, made a big show of how religious he was. His wife wore a headscarf. I want to tell you that in Turkey, in the mid-90s, women were not wearing headscarves for the most part in Istanbul. So when his wife showed up wearing a headscarf, that was a big statement. And that's where Erdogan came to power, was as what was called an Islamist party. Now, that's different than some of the others in the Middle East, but it was definitely moving the country, or an attempt to move against Atatürk's very hardline secularism in Turkey.
Even though over the years Erdogan's reputation has been one of a moderate Muslim leader, respecting the secular tradition of the founder Atatürk, Turkey itself has not been immune from sectarian violence. This despite determined military insistence on the necessity of secularism. Ms. Bardak recalls the firebombing of a meeting of democratic secular academics back in 1963, which wiped out a good portion of the Turkish intelligentsia.
A lot of people don't know that even though Islamic fundamentalist violence was much less so in Turkey, there was some. And in 1993, and this is when Erdogan was coming to power, there was a terrible attack, and it was literally on a conference on secularism, and it was held in a hotel in what was called a welfare, that was his political party, territory, an area. They torched that place, and 37 of Turkey's premier intellectuals and academics were killed. Intellectuals died in that fire. And there was a frenzied crowd outside chanting, "Victory belongs to Islam."
Despite his almost total control of the media and propaganda outlets, Erdogan's victory was quite narrow, less than 3% of the vote. This certainly aroused suspicions among European leaders, who until recently had been courting Turkey to join the EU, and are now far less enthusiastic. As for the vote count itself, Anne Bardak reminds us of the Turkish Welfare Party's experience in manipulating the ballot. Following the failed July coup attempt, Erdogan has cracked down on all members of civil society he deems hostile to his political aims: military officers, academics, judges, civil servants, and, of course, journalists. This particularly pains Anne Bardak and all of us here, who continues by comparing Erdogan to another strongman, Vladimir Putin, in Russia. She also comments on his commercial ties to Donald Trump, who is still interested in completing a Trump Tower in Istanbul.
I am so worried that some of the most prominent reporters who I interviewed in the mid-90s are in prison now. I mean, it's so troubling. He has used this coup, and his reaction is so extreme that many observers, smart observers, wonder whether he might have staged it, you know, in the way that Putin, after the apartment building explosions in Moscow,
used it
as a pretext to break into Chechnya. Now, the very smartest Russian observers today say, you know, they have written documentaries and films and say that Putin actually staged that himself. It sounds like a conspiracy theory, but if you talk to someone like Masha Gessen, she doesn't have any doubt. And by the way, Erdogan is very much in the mold of Vladimir Putin. And there's another subtext here that he has been emboldened by Donald Trump. When Obama was president and Erdogan did these kinds of shenanigans, which more than shenanigans, but Obama, there would be leverage. There would be we want international observers there to count ballots. You know, there would be a list of demands, and there would be a lot of carrot and stick. There's a backstory here because Donald Trump had a very big building project. He had a Trump Towers project in Istanbul. I believe it's in Istanbul.
It is in Istanbul, indeed.
And he was teamed with one of Turkey's top developers. And when he announced the anti-Muslim ban, Erdogan, you know, kind of put the whole project on ice. And other things. He just wasn't getting movement on the Trump Towers. But as soon as he became president, he established very, very cordial relationships with Turkey. We know that General Flynn and other members of the Trump administration met with the highest levels of Turkey's and Erdogan's government. And began literally talking Turkey.
Finally, we agree this is a bad time for Turkey and the West. Turkey's secular traditions and open intellectual life have clearly taken a serious blow, while literally millions of refugees from the Syrian civil war are virtually held hostage on Turkish soil, some within sight of Europe on the horizon, where they may never arrive. This is Harry Lawton reporting.